Case number 15-7126, David D. Jesus, appellant versus WP Company, LLC, doing business as Washington Post. Mr. Morgan Roth for the appellant, Ms. Holmes for the appellee.
Did you want me to file that supplemental information?
No. We would have told you. Thank you.
Court, please. Mayor Morgan Roth appearing on behalf of the appellant. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
Mr. Morgan Roth, if you could pull the
pen down
a little bit. Thank you.
Where have I heard that before? Thank you. This is a particular matter regarding an Afro-American client and a particular person who was employed by the Washington Post for 18 years. He came in on a particular 6 month usual type visit to his boss, and when he came in, he was handed a resignation package and told he either was going to resign or he's going to be fired without any warning, without any investigation, without anything except that particular statement, and then escorted out of the building and told in 21 days he had to either give his resignation or he's through. In any event, he was a person who was there for 18 years, brought in $1 billion with the business, but what happened in 2008 towards the end was Catherine Weymouth became the publisher, and all of a sudden, the, shall we say, the purposes sort of changed, where now Afro-American employees, as well as employees over 40, were given the gate, so to speak. The reason given for Mr. DeJesus' termination were, number one, ordering a purportedly unauthorized RAM study for an important client, Allstate Insurance Company. Didn't have to be authorized. All the evidence in the arbitration and elsewhere in the depositions and affidavits, there was no such requirement that it had to be authorized. And on top of it, Mr. DeJesus discussed it by emails and otherwise with his boss, so to speak, Ms. Wainwright, who never said you had to be authorized, and in fact only gave the instruction, show it to the client before you show it to the advertising agent, which he did. He gave it to the client in a meeting. Of course, the client was Stacy Sharp, who was an African American, which didn't particularly please Ms. Wainwright anyway, who once before, when that particular person was invited to a function and was supposed to sit at the same table with them, Ms. Wainwright said, no way, she's not a good fit, despite the fact she was a high official at a big company, Allstate, that brought business to the company. She wasn't a good fit. And by the way, that was what was put on to the particular reason to fire Mr. DeJesus. He wasn't a good fit any longer. Of course he wasn't. He was 59 years old, an African American. Which went on further. The second reason was delivering the favorable results to Allstate. Stacy Sharp, a high-level African-American executive, instead of Karen Hornberger, who was a high-level white Allstate executive. That was quite strange because Stacy Sharp was the particular person that he always dealt with and who was his higher level, who had the chick.
I think you need to focus on what we can do. I mean, we've said numerous times that we're not a super personnel board where we can't really judge the merits of whether these reasons necessarily make sense. If they are, if the reasons for the termination are reasons that are legitimate reasons, whether we would agree with them or not, if we were running the company, it doesn't really matter. It's whether, if they are legitimate reasons, did they honestly believe them? That's the first question. And I think you need to spend your time focusing on that.
I sort of was, Your Honor. I was showing why they were not legitimate reasons. Because specifically, even the second item about Karen Hornberger, he'd only met her once in 18 years for a couple of minutes. That was an excuse. And by the way, there is emails back and forth.
But I think the question is, I thought this was what Judge Wilkins was getting at, is that whether they're legitimate or illegitimate is different from whether the representatives of the Post believe that they were legitimate.
I understood right? that, Your Honor. And that's why I was addressing the fact that how could they believe it when all of the documentation, all of the emails, said the opposite. The email said, show it to the client. Did not say Karen Hornberger at any time. That's what I was getting at. So how could you say that you're fired for not showing it to Karen Hornberger instead of Stacy Sharp when Karen Hornberger was never once mentioned in any of the communications back and forth? Only show it to the client. Not to Karen Hornberger. That's what I'm getting at. And it was the same thing when it came to authorization. There was an email back to our client, to Mr. DeJesus, not saying you weren't authorized at any time before he did it or after he did it, only instructing him to give it to the client before the advertising agency. All the evidence shows that those particular statements that, you know, for his firing were false. And they knew they were false because in the arbitration there was testimony given by Ms. Wainwright that she was found unpersuasive and not believable. And the arbitration found that the termination of DeJesus was without just or sufficient cause, entirely unfounded, entirely. Uninvestigated, which is another thing. Where's due process? No investigation, just walks in. And the reason why, you can assume the reason why they did that way is because they didn't want any documentation by him that would show up again showing that this was all baloney. And then it was in violation of the post-disciplinary policies. And there was no due process, a lack of due process. That's what the arbitrator found. And by the way, the arbitrator was picked by both sides, was independent, who had experience for years in the labor world. On top of it, the arbitration was done with the rules of evidence. And the particular witnesses, and they had witnesses, it wasn't just argument. They were examined, cross-examined, and it was like a full trial. They cited the Grimes case. The Grimes case, it was the particular arbitrator was picked by one side. That's not the case here.
Can I ask you about a slightly different issue? There's some discussion in the record here about other people who were terminated, other people who were fired during this period, and it appears that there was some attempt to gain discovery about those other terminations.
Well, there were,
you got some information, but not all of it. And one of the things that the district court judge says here is that's not very helpful because they had to be in the same situation as he was. So one question that occurs to me is why Mr. DeJesus did not pursue that discovery.
We did. We got discovery, and in discovery from 2009 to 2011, there were 56 employees with buyouts like he was. Of those, 47 were African-American, one Hispanic, and 48 of those were over 40. Almost all of them fit in to the protected class. What happened was we wanted more.
That's what I'm asking you. In other words, what I thought the district court said here was they are not similarly situated.
Well, that's what the district court said. But what we were asking for was to show that they were similarly situated, that they were African-American and were over 40. The district court didn't give us going back to 2008, but the ones we had in 2009, 2010, leading up right to 2011. As I said, 55 we got, and 47 were African-American of them, one Hispanic, and 48 of them were over 40 years old. Almost all of them fit into a protected class. How do you do that? One department, they got rid of almost everybody completely. They were all African-American, just got rid of them. And there's evidence all over the place of how they discriminated against African-Americans in over 40s. The point is your question, I really liked to a large extent because, and yours too, because the lower court became the jury. What the lower court did was decide the issues of fact, as they thought. However, the problem was, is they didn't give, or the court did not give, to the plaintiff, so to speak, a prima facie case, which was established. And there was all kinds of discrimination shown. He was shown not to be a good fit. That's what they showed for Stacy Sharp. That's a remark. She was African-American. She couldn't sit at the table. She's not a good fit. Why? They did the same thing with a whole group of African-Americans and put them right in the center in one close portion, all African-Americans. What happened to separate, to an equal all of a sudden? We're back to segregation? Then they got a picture in the wall and a bunch of pictures, and all the pictures show mayors and presidents and whatever, all with prestige. One picture of an African-American, Barry, showing him putting in drugs into his arm. What do you do? There's a particular person that comes in with a Ku Klux Klan everyday belt. Nobody says a word about that. They don't stop him from having it. What kind of a situation is that where they condone that kind of behavior and actually perform it themselves? The fact of the matter is there was evidence of affidavits, testimony, with cross-examination, depositions that all supported the particular allegations of the plaintiff. And there was nothing that supported the defendant except Wainwright saying, well, that's what I thought. But then she continually and repeatedly, every time she testified, changed her testimony, every time she gave an affidavit. And then later on said, well, I forgot. It was a long time ago, and that's what the counsel said. Except one problem. She testified the first time shortly afterwards in the arbitration. How could she have forgotten? And then she testified again in the particular proceedings. But on top of it, she helped them put together the interrogatory answers, telling me she took a deposition and she helped them put together the sworn interrogatory answers without being, shall we say, shown her past experiences. But on top of it, she testified the first time shortly after in the arbitration itself. And every time she had a different story.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Jacqueline Holmes for the Appellee, The Washington Post. I'd like to start, Judge Wilkins, with a response to your question regarding whether or not there was an honest belief on behalf of Ms. Wainwright. Ms. Wainwright testified over and over and over in this case that in her mind and in her view, client means the person with advertising budget decision-making authority. Let me just give you one example, and this is in her deposition at 183, which is in the joint appendix at 531. The client, by our definition, are those that have budgets and can make decisions. That's the definition for us. And that's over and over again in the record. You'll find it at 519, 522 of the joint appendix.
Let me interrupt you and tell you the two problems that I have in this case.
Okay.
From your perspective. It seems that there are the two principal reasons given for the termination of Mr. De Jesus here. Is that first, he ordered a RAM study without seeking proper authorization.
Correct.
When that came up in email traffic, Ms. Wainwright responded, no worries.
In the end, she did. That's correct. There was some traffic prior to that, and I think this was misstated a bit.
But she said that before this letter of termination came out, right?
That's correct.
Okay. The second reason is you informed me that you did not meet with the client when you delivered the study, but instead only met with their agency and with the local client contact with no advertising decision-making ability or budgetary oversight.
Correct.
So that's in the termination.
Correct.
In the arbitration, she testified that he was fired because he hadn't met with anybody to discuss the study, which contradicts the termination letter. So if we take the evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, which is what we're supposed to do.
Correct.
Don't we have evidence from which a jury could find that these two statements, Ms. Wainwright has changed her story on or testified on, or at least the first statement was false because she went from no worries to it being the grounds for termination?
So I think the answer is no, and let me explain why, Your Honor. With regard to the RAM study, the first thing she said to him is, I should have been aware of this before we moved forward. And she's testified consistently that in her department she did require approval. And he doesn't undermine that. He says she didn't, but he had never done it before. So again, there's nothing undermining her honest belief in that regard. Yes, at the end of the exchange she said no worries because, as she explained in her deposition and elsewhere, we were where we were, and what I wanted to do was make the best of it and move this forward by trying to go to the client, meaning, in her words, the person with decision-making authority, and try to use this information to get more of the advertising dollars from Allstate, which in her mind was the whole purpose of the exercise, right? It's the whole purpose of the job, is to move dollars from one place to another. With regard to the sharp inconsistency, I agree there was an inconsistency. She did not remember at the time of the arbitration that he had given it to Sharp. But in her mind, it was irrelevant in the sense that he was supposed to go to the client, which for her is the person with the purse.
Those are all good arguments, but aren't they arguments for a jury?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I don't think it undermines her honest belief. There's nothing undermining her honest belief in this record. There's nothing undermining the notion that she didn't genuinely believe that the client meant the person with the purse. I mean, I think the district court got that right. And the arbitration award doesn't undermine that, because that's not what it was.
The jury couldn't reasonably believe that if she says no worries in an email, but then later says this is grounds for termination, that perhaps the grounds for termination isn't really as credible. Or is it the real reason?
I think that it's the two things together, right? I don't think that the RAM study alone would have gotten him dismissed. I think what happened is that Wainwright reached her breaking point when he then didn't follow her instructions. And it's pretty clear that he didn't follow her instructions. And I think there's also, just to be clear, some evidence in the record that shows that he knew he wasn't following her instructions. The Sharp meeting was set on May 24th. Set in stone, it's going to be on June 6th. He knows that on May 24th. On May 27th, she emails him and says, you know, Mr. De Jesus, I want you to make sure you get a meeting with the client. Please give me a status update. Now, if what he says in this litigation is true, that meeting with Sharp complied with those instructions, and that's what he says, you would expect the response to that email to be, I've got a meeting on June 6th with Ms. Sharp, and I'm going to provide that information to her. It's not what he says. He says, I'm nailing down dates. What does that mean? He's nailing down dates with the agency. So he never comes to her and says, I'm meeting with Sharp. If he'd come to her and said, I'm meeting with Sharp, and she said, fine, and then later changed course, I mean, I would completely agree with you. That's not what he did. And then she asked him again on June 1st, you know, what's the status of the meeting with the client? Not the agency, the client. And he responds, the meeting June 8th. That's the agency. Never discloses the meeting with Sharp. And I think there's that piece of this as well. There's nothing undermining her honest belief that the client was the person with the purse. And there's no dispute that he didn't meet with the person with the purse. There's no dispute about that at all. There's also, I think, you also need to be able to infer, I think, that race or age may have motivated the dismissal. And here, there's no evidence of that. And in fact, there's substantial evidence that undermines that. His principal complaints about Wainwright relate to yelling, berating him, that type of thing. All things that he admits younger and Caucasian employees also experienced working for Wainwright, which I think substantially undermines any notion that any of this was race or age-based. He also was in the same race and age-protected categories the entire time he worked for Wainwright, and indeed the entire time he worked for the Washington Post.
So before we get too far into that, at least in some situations, if the stated justification is implausible, the implausibility of stated justification itself can be taken as evidence of an illicit motive.
It can be evidence. I'm not sure alone it's enough. I think what the court has said are things like, in addition.
Well, it can be. It certainly can be in certain situations. You don't always have to have more. I think our cases have said, and logic would suggest, that if the company is towing one line in terms of the justification, it turns out that completely blows up. And then what's left on the table is an illicit motivation, then the fact that you've blown up the stated justification itself could be enough. I'm not saying that happened here. I'm just saying
conceptually. I think that what those cases say, at least to my recollection, is that plus, for example, evidence of a prima facie case, which was never analyzed here because Brady, right? We don't analyze the prima facie case. But I do think there has to be some indication that race or age may have motivated. That is the ultimate question. And I do think here there's substantial evidence indeed undercutting that. There's certainly no evidence of a grand discriminatory plan, for example. To get to your question, Judge Brown, about discovery, they did get discovery on 142 people dismissed by the Post in this time frame. The 55 that they're talking about is in their responses to interrogatories. They listed 55 people with knowledge, all of whom took buyouts, and thus are not similarly situated to the plaintiff, as Aliotta clearly holds. If you look at the 142, you really can't draw any inferences of discrimination.
So before we go, let's just assume for purposes of argument that I'm right about this, okay? Now, if I am, and we're back on the question of whether the stated justification was blown up, on the piece of it that you view to be most pivotal, which is the notion that client means person with budgetary authority, if she testifies, look, I always thought client meant person with budgetary authority. There's nothing in any of the evidence that suggests that calls into doubt whether I actually thought
correct.
That. I mean, that might be true because I don't know what you're supposed to do. All you can do is ask, and the person says, that's what I always thought.
Well, so, you could find emails of her referring to people without that authority as the client. I mean, they got emails back to 2008. There are other ways to prove that up, right?
So what is your best? So if that's where we are, the Post, through her testimony, says, look, when I said client, I meant someone with budgetary authority. And the plaintiff says, well, no, you never said that, and that's true, too. That was never clearly communicated, the client meant somebody with budgetary authority. So now we're basically at a stalemate. So the question becomes, what is a plaintiff in that situation supposed to do to stave off summary judgment if what they need to show, if what they need to send to the jury is what was in the person's mind?
Well, I think it's just like every other denial of misconduct. I mean, that's essentially a denial of misconduct, right? It's you didn't tell me you weren't clear enough and I didn't do anything wrong. And we know that's not enough under the cases. So what's the plaintiff supposed to do? He's supposed to do something to undermine that explanation. What might he do? He might find email communications or other communications of her communicating that the client is Sharp, For example, in this case, what the plaintiff might have done is told her he was meeting with Scherr, which he had multiple opportunities to do, and then have her say yes or no. And if she says yes, and then she comes back and says Sharp wasn't good enough, he's got a good case.
Did he put it in Salesforce?
He did put it in Salesforce, Your Honor. And
did he put it in Salesforce contemporaneously?
I believe he did.
Did she look in Salesforce?
She did not look in Salesforce for that purpose. Again, this is uncontroverted.
Isn't that evidence?
It is not, for two reasons. One, because Salesforce, she testified without contradiction that she didn't look at Salesforce for that purpose. She pulled reports out of Salesforce, how many sales calls are her reps making, that kind of thing. And again, without any contradiction, she testified, I did not go in there to look at individual emails. But more importantly here, why would she look in Salesforce? She asked him the question, and he answered the question in email. My meeting's on June 8th. She's supposed to assume he's lying and run around trying to scour through Salesforce and figure out what the actual answer is? That doesn't make any sense in this case.
You say she asked him the question, what are you referring to?
She asked him specifically in emails on May 27th and June 1st, after the May 24th, after the meeting with Sharp was set up, please tell me about the status of your meeting with Allstate. She asked him repeatedly, and he never responded, it's on June 6th with Stacey Sharp. He could have done that. It was already set up. There's no dispute about that. And so it makes no sense to say, well, I didn't tell you the whole story, boss, so you need to go back and hunt through Salesforce and find out what the real story is. It was not unreasonable for her to think, okay, it's on June 8th. He's telling me it's on June 8th, right? So I don't think the Salesforce gets him anywhere in this case for those reasons.
Well, one thing that I find kind of unusual about this case is the arbitration.
Yes.
Okay. And what's interesting about that is that that arbitration deals with the collective bargaining agreement.
That's correct.
Which presumably she was his supervisor and she was aware of what was required under that collective bargaining agreement, right?
To a degree. She got advice from the vice president.
So if she believed that this was insubordination and neglect of duty, presumably she knew what it would take to demonstrate that. And I think, there's no dispute that the arbitrator finds that that was not done, right? That they didn't investigate it, that it wasn't clearly conveyed to him. In order to have insubordination, he has to be willfully not doing what he's told to do.
And presumably, for gross misconduct. That's
correct. Yeah, presumably they found that he was not willfully doing that because it wasn't clearly told to him.
And that's why we lost the arbitration, for sure.
Right. So why doesn't that impact on whether or not this was pretextual when we get to the civil case?
Because, look, we lost the arbitration because the burden was on the post to prove gross misconduct, which means we had to prove a clear order. And we had to prove notice of the consequences. And the arbitrator held we didn't prove that. And again, that's why we lost. But I don't think, for one thing, as to Wainwright's knowledge, she was getting advice from others. She was not an expert in the collective bargaining agreement and didn't purport to be. Post has other people for that. But so none of that undermines, though, whether she honestly believed that she had told him to give it to the client and what she meant by the client. Whether the clarity of the order, I think the district court got this exactly right, the clarity of the order is not what's at issue anymore. The burden is on him to prove that she is engaged in pretext, that she's not telling the truth about the reasons, about her reasons. And there's nothing in the arbitration that undermines that. The arbitrator certainly found she didn't give a clear order, but let's assume that's true. That doesn't mean she didn't honestly believe that by referring to the client, which again, in her parlance is client is person with advertising budgetary decision-making authority, because that's what the job is, and she says that over and over, the job is to get people to move money from the Wall Street Journal to the Washington Post. And when the burden is on him to prove that it is that our reasons are untrue, that's quite a different burden than we had in the arbitration, when again, the burden was on us to prove a clear order, and we didn't do it, and that's why he was reinstated, that's why he has his back pay, and we acknowledge that. I know my time has expired, so if there are any other questions, I'd be happy to. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Mr. Morgenroth, you can have 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. First of all, in the testimony of Ms. Wainwright, she testified that Sharp had significant budgetary influence and impact upon media decisions. She admitted to that. She also admitted that she was a highly influential member of Allstate's marketing team, and also that she reported directly to the chairman of Allstate. She testified to that. Also, it is stated everywhere at the company, all the way up to the president of the Post, that if it's not in the sales force, it never happened. That's a quote. Managers like Wainwright were required to track all salespersons' activity continuously on the sales force. She admitted to that in her deposition, Ms. Wainwright. Also, excuse me.
But isn't it a little bit anomalous that when she asked this direct question about the meeting, he doesn't just respond, yes, I've set up the meeting?
Your Honor, he responded several times to her and told her about the meeting. She knew about the meeting. And when the June 6th meeting took place, this is all in Salesforce, too, he let her know immediately it had taken place. Then he had a June 8th meeting afterwards with a salesperson from the particular agency, which he was told by her to have second. On June the 20th, when he met with Ms. Wainwright, they discussed all that. Yet on June 27th, he gets terminated. By the way, I did want to also respond about the district court, who wouldn't allow us the demographic of all the employees' buyouts, similarly situated. The judge said because only terminations were relevant. That's why we didn't get that evidence. And he wasn't terminated. He withdrew rather than be terminated. That's what the judge said. We couldn't get that evidence. And then dismissed the case because we didn't have that evidence.
So why didn't you appeal the discovery?
Well, that would have been, an appeal during the course of the proceedings.
Well, but I mean, raise it at least with the district court, object to that decision?
Well, we objected at the time.
Reconsideration?
Reconsideration, but it didn't do any good. Nothing did any good. And also, she testified herself, Ms. Wainwright, that the sole rule was a study that measured consumers. That's all she testified there. And there was no approval that she could show that was actually required.
Okay. All right.
I guess that pretty much takes my time.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.